This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 198. Today we speak with Dr. Daryl G. Hart about evangelicals and conservatism. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 198. My name is Camden Busey. We have another great one lined up for you, a more informal, friendly discussion. It's just me and my very special guest. I'm very pleased to welcome to the program today, Dr. Daryl G. Hart, who is a visiting professor.
I am.
At Hillsdale College, right. In Hillsdale, Michigan. Welcome back to the program, Daryl. It's great to have you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
My former elder.
Yes.
No longer have a shepherding authority over me, so I know.
Indirectly. I'm now back. I'm back in the saddle. I'm actually part of the provisional session
at Hillsdale.
Yeah. So, through the bonds of our communion,
so I'll have to scratch a few questions off of my list here. No, I'm kidding. We're very pleased to be back in the studio and to line up these last few interviews before we hit episode 200. And I'm very excited to have Daryl in town today. He's visiting for some OPC business. So we're able to pull him aside during some of his free time to discuss two things. We're going to get two episodes out of this time today in the studio. But the book today that we want to speak about is From Billy Graham to Sarah Palin, Evangelicals and the Betrayal of American Conservatism. It is published by Erdmans. And before we get into the discussion of this book, I do need to mention a few housekeeping items. The first being that Reformed Forum is, of course, listener-supported, and I also want to mention that we are a 501c3 organization now, fully recognized by the IRS. So now, yeah, Daryl's giving the thumbs up. That is a big deal. You know, as having worked with many 501c3s in the past, it's not easy to get that. And so we're very excited to mention that, to announce that, and also in conjunction with that, please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. And the reason I mention that is because it is your support and donations that make these programs possible. They provide for us to be able to buy equipment, to be able to have the website and distribute the files, because that can be costly, as well as for us to schedule guests and other things we need. We have administrative costs and other types of costs, so please visit us online and donate today. And now, because we're a 501c3, those gifts are all tax-exempt. You can deduct them from your taxes if you itemize. So visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate and help us to continue to produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. We thank you so much for your support of everything we do at Reformed Forum and this program, Christ the Center. Also, keeping the ads off the air. You know, we don't want to have to try to go into sponsorship model, although we might have to in the future. But please visit us online and keep this ad-free as much as we can. Well, Daryl, we have it's that time of year again. It seems to get earlier and earlier in the election cycle.
Right.
You know, the YouTube debates are in full swing. I think they've had three debates now for the Republican nomination, and we're more than a year in.
Right.
More than a year out from the
and Sarah
from the election.
Still isn't even in the race
yet. We've got as we're recording now, whiffs of the Rick Perry thing seems to have run out of steam in a course of about 2 weeks. You know, his stock price in the Iowa electronic markets, which I follow, is now fallen. The other category has surpassed him as of yesterday.
Wow.
That's what happens when you have a poor showing in a debate.
Well, and the name of the hunting lodge or camp or whatever that you just don't want to. There are certain things you just can't get away from. So,
yeah,
man.
And then the whiffs in this area of the Chris Christie run, you know, and being the governor of New Jersey. Who knows? There's so much politics in the air. So we have this excellent book here in front of us from Billy Graham to Sarah Palin, Evangelicals and the Betrayal of American Conservatism. Now, you are responsible for changing my pronunciation from evangelical to evangelical. And this was done when we had a conversation on your books, your book, Deconstructing Evangelicalism.
Right.
What's the insight to that? And what's the difference in pronunciation?
Well, actually, I've been doing a number of interviews for this book, and only because I think Erdmann's thinks it's going to sell well. So it's not necessarily by any virtue of the book itself.
It's timely.
I had a friend, I have a friend still, but from Wheaton days, who said, and you have to be very conscious of this in Wheaton.
Oh, it's the epicenter.
That
really,
if you say evangelical with the strong E, the long E, you are an evangelical.
Right.
And if you use a short E, evangelical, then you are not an evangelical.
Right.
And I've also discovered in doing some of these interviews that if you say conservatism. Mm-hmm. Chances are you know what conservatism is. But if you say conservativism,
right,
add that extra syllable in there,
right,
generally speaking, you're probably not that familiar with conservative.
I have to catch myself here, because I don't want to trip over my tongue in doing the interviews.
No,
because
I'm not,
the modern parlance is to say conservativism. It
right.
just seems to be more in the air.
Right.
To say conservatism. It does betray a little bit that you've read a book or two about
right.
the subject.
Right.
And so I'm glad you point that out. As we get started, we need to define a few terms, and the
sure.
first being those two terms. I don't imagine, I don't presume that you would condense the entire book, Deconstructing Evangelicalism, in just a few sentences, but can you provide for the listeners your definition, or at least broad few sentence explanation for what you think an evangelical is,
right? Well,
what the
especially
movement is?
For the book itself, I think the abstraction of evangelicalism is a kind of Protestantism that emphasizes the born again experience and that has a higher view of Scripture, and so Jesus, me, and my Bible sort of thing mm-hmm. is maybe. A little too crass, but, kind of a working understanding of evangelicalism. But historically, and that's what the book really is, it's an account of evangelical reflection about America and politics since World War II. And that's the period when evangelicals in the form of the National Association of Evangelicals and Christianity Today and Fuller Seminary mm-hmm. and Billy Graham, when that movement took shape and that's an important for a period for understanding conservatism as well. So I'll just morph into
sure.
that, because that's the same period in the 1950s when the modern American conservative movement got its legs in figures such as Russell Kirk writing the book The Conservative Mind in 1953, or National Review founded around 1955 mm-hmm. with William F. Buckley Jr. And so you have the rise of modern conservatism, American conservatism in the 50s. And what I was trying to find out partly in the book was how much evangelicals were thinking about or reading American conservatives or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so when was it that the two sort of converged or not? This is a historical inquiry in that sense, and
right.
not simply even though it's timely and it's relevant to the current political campaigns, especially Republican primaries, it's much more historical.
Yeah.
So readers who want to go in there and find it, who want to pick up this
which,
book and find about
which
Perry
person to vote for or something.
Or Bachman,
yeah.
they're going to be sorely disappointed.
Right.
The people will also be disappointed. They'll say, there's not any. I saw the first review on Amazon came out, and the woman said, there's nothing in there on Palin. Well, that's actually not true. Palin's in the introduction of the book. I mean, it's not just in the title. I do try to interact with Palin, and I hope she runs for the sake of sales of the book as well. But
well, you never know. At least she's running for media queen or something of the sort. She seems to be
kind of queen.
Something. She's the darling of Fox News. You mentioned about evangelicalism and conservatism since Reagan. How can we understand Jimmy Carter in this mix? Is there a reason that you
right.
start post-Carter? You mentioned him a few times throughout the book, but
right.
really on page two, your analysis seems to start with the Reagan era.
Well, the Reagan Revolution is really when a Republican strategy to peel away Democratic voters succeeded. And I mean, the culture wars of the 60s and 70s, particularly the sexual revolution, feminism, and the breakup of the family and sexual license, all that came with that, made parts of the Democratic constituency, that, which was always cobbled together, this odd working class, immigrant, urban communities with the rural South. I mean, mm-hmm. how you keep those various constituencies together is a real conundrum. But it worked from FDR down to roughly Carter. But in the 70s, that constituency really starts to fragment. And Republicans saw that evangelicals in the South, who traditionally voted Democratic because of the legacy of the Civil War, and also conservative ethnic Catholics, could perhaps be peeled away from the Democratic Party because of these sexual issues or marriage issues or family issues. And so Reagan, you know, is responsible for luring so-called Reagan Democrats mm-hmm. from the Democratic Party into the Republican Party. But Reagan himself was a Democrat. And so he's the Reagan Democrat. Mm-hmm. You know, so that you have this electoral shift where the Republican Party really does pick up in the late 70s, these former Democrats. And Carter is important, if only because he's the first one to talk about being a born-again Protestant for someone running for the presidency. And he's also someone whom the evangelicals at the period, Falwell, Tim LaHaye, Dobson, hoped might actually do some good things. And my colleague at Hillsdale College, who has an interesting book coming out on evangelicals and contraception, Alan Carlson is the historian, says that Carter had a real chance to woo evangelicals into the Democratic fold. He sponsored a conference on the family during his administration in the 70s. But instead of doing a sort of traditional understanding of marriage and family, which is still incredibly pressing for our time today, he decided to do a conference on the American families, plural, suggesting a diversity of approaches to the family, suggesting, you know, the multicultural agenda, perhaps, of the Democratic Party. And so Carter lost
not only multicultural, but, well, I guess it would be cultural, but alternative lifestyle.
Right, yeah. Right. And so Carter lost a real opportunity to keep, and evangelicals became very frustrated with the Carter administration. And again, Republicans were there in the waiting, looking to pick up on these voters. It had already been happening in some ways with Nixon's administration and the silent majority. They all were already aware of a kind of God and country vote that they could pick up on.
But, interesting. Now, you, of course, in the use of the word born again, you're emphasizing the emphasis on this really sharp conversion experience in someone's life. You're not using it in the John 3 sense of regeneration, right?
Well, I mean, it
can be both.
It can be.
But you're also distinguishing between the two. Some people might hear it and say, well, isn't every Christian really a born-again Christian?
Right.
But in the use of your book and the historical analysis, you're speaking of people like Carter and certain evangelicals who would emphasize this and this experience that you can pinpoint in your life.
Right. Right? As opposed to, I mean, so conversion becomes the entrance into life, into spiritual life, as opposed to baptism. And I'm not saying that I'm not in any way affirming baptismal regeneration or something like that. But there is a sense in confessional Protestantism that you can, you know, perhaps never have a conversion experience, that you can you can just grow up in the faith and eventually embrace it and make it your own when you make public profession, you know, age 11, age 18, whatever that may be. So, but it's also, I mean, part of what I'm saying too is that people who, I mean, the born again experience in some ways stands for this, in my estimation, a little shaky understanding of having Jesus in my heart. I mean, I believe that the Holy Spirit, you know, resides in believers. I mean, I'm not in any way discounting that, but this, it's a kind of folksy understanding of the presence of Jesus.
But there might be some evangelicals or people that would identify themselves as evangelical that would come to a Reformed person and ask, when did you have your conversion experience? And they could say, oh, I've never had a day where I didn't know that I was saved. And they might discredit that because they lack the experience.
Right, exactly.
So that's another caricature, but that's part of what you're reacting against. So what we pray for in the Reformed world for our children is that they would grow up never knowing a day in which they didn't know the Lord. We hope for that.
Right.
And so somebody might grow up and profess faith publicly at 11 or 18 or however
right.
old, and not be able to pinpoint that's the day that the Lord saved me.
Right.
But that's all separate, or at least tangential, to the question of what's going on theologically and spiritually with what the Spirit's doing in somebody's life. That's not, I just want to clarify that right. for the listeners.
But and the other side of this, too, is that the emphasis on born again experience or conversion or even regeneration has historically in American Protestantism meant that if you're converted, church membership really doesn't matter.
Mm.
So where you go to church, what your church teaches, participating in the sacramental life of the church or whatever, those things really,
yeah.
they're peripheral to mm-hmm. your relationship with Jesus. Mm-hmm. That's what's really primary. So, you know, there are plenty of people in confessional churches that have a high view of conversion experience
uh-huh.
that prize revivals, and I get in trouble with those people oftentimes. And I'm glad to talk to those people and discuss some of these things. But it has been the case that someone like a Billy Graham, and you can hear it in his radio broadcast still, or Franklin Graham saying, you know, Christianity isn't about going to church. Well, in a sense, I understand that, but in a sense, well,
yeah,
there's no, ordinarily, there's no salvation outside the church, as the confession teaches. So,
isn't it interesting what we expect of the president? Many people want to hear about somebody's personal life or a conversion experience, but yet they don't, those same people that might vote for a president because of they've had a conversion experience don't get upset when the president never attends a church or never observes the sacrament or does
right.
anything like that. Well, he's busy. He's taking care of national defense or something. He can't come on a Sunday. Well, I find it curious, the things that people prize and get really worked up about in terms of voting.
Right. I mean, my explanation for this is, and I've been saying this to freshmen at Hillsdale, we're covering some of the Roman Empire emperors right now, Augustus and Nero and Justinian, and you know, the character matters in when you have so much power in one person.
Oh yeah.
So Nero was a terrible
mm-hmm.
emperor and a bad character, Marcus Aurelius seems to be a fairly interesting guy, even though he may not have treated Christians that well. So as the presidency in the United States has become increasingly powerful, especially in the context of war, both two world wars and then Cold War and now war against terrorism, you could consolidate and centralize a lot of power in order to execute those wars. And so conservatives used to look to Congress as the most important of the branches of the federal government, because that was the most representative. That was the way to conserve what was happening in the country more. Mm-hmm. It was the most deliberative body. But in a context of war and the efficiency and making decisions, the presidency emerges as a much more important place. And so because one person can make the decisions. Well, then you want, if so much power is going to one person, you want somebody with good character.
Of course.
And so religion has become a way to test that in American politics, even though 50 years ago, I mean, it was an issue with John F. Kennedy simply because he was Roman Catholic. If
mm-hmm.
he weren't Roman Catholic, no one really would have asked about his mm-hmm. religion. But now we want to know about the religion or the beliefs of our candidates.
Depending on what the current issue is, because 4 years ago, the Mormonism was a huge deal with Romney, and now it never comes up.
Right.
Or very rarely comes
up.
Well,
I think it probably still will, but...
But not yet.
Right. So religion has become there's no test for office, religious
no.
test for office in the United States, but with the American public, there is right now, because I think it has a lot to do with this issue of character. We think
mm-hmm.
someone who is religious is going to be a person of character
mm-hmm.
or virtue, trustworthy. And I don't, you know, I mean, that's, we do have this notion in evangelical Protestantism of nominal Christianity. Somebody can say all sorts of things and still not necessarily believe it. So why would you necessarily trust someone who in a public debate or in a speech is
sure.
saying these things as if as if they don't have speechwriters, as if they don't...
they haven't tested these words and phrases
right.
to focus groups.
I mean, I don't mean to be cynical, but...
It's just the way things work.
Right.
It is. It's unfortunate, but that's just how... It's a game. It really is. Gone are the days when, you know, you have Lincoln and Douglas debating for 3 hours, and the 3 hours was spent on introductions to their argument. You can read Neil Postman on this. You know, we've now the debates are held on YouTube, and we can't really think of anything. Our minds can't comprehend, the public's mind can't comprehend anything larger than a 45-second clip.
Right.
And so the politicking has morphed so much to accommodate that, and who knows if it was the chicken or the egg that came first, but that's where we are right now. You're looking for sound bites and sound clips because that's the world we inhabit. It's rough. Now, you speak about the developments, and now having come to the end of your analysis, having written the book, do you think the stage is properly set for a so-called divorce between evangelicals and conservatives? Have they been sufficiently decoupled?
Well, electorally, they will still be together, partly because we in the American political system, we really only have two parties. So there are various liberals, people on the left, and they basically only have one option, which is the Democratic Party. Sometimes there'll be a third
Green,
party candidate,
a splinter
Nader,
group
or mm-hmm. on the right, if you want to call that the right, someone like Russ Perot,
yeah.
that will take away votes from
the liberal
from one of the mainstream parties. But mm-hmm. generally speaking, electorally, everyone who's liberal or on the left is going to wind up voting for a Democrat. And same thing on the right. So conservatives and evangelicals, even though they may approach politics and their understanding of politics differently, may look the same when it comes the first Tuesday in November. Mm-hmm. You know, and so just judging on their votes.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that, I mean, evangelicals have been in the 70s for most of the Republican candidates. I mean, maybe it went up to 80s, maybe the first Bush election, I'm not sure. I've been saying this on different interviews, that maybe by 2024, evangelicals could be 50-50 Republican, Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think generationally, the greatest generation is dying off.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been solidly Republican, especially since Reagan. The baby boomers are very much mixed, although marriage and abortion are still pretty important to a lot of boomers, which could keep them in the Republican fold, depending on how much other humanitarian kinds of issues emerge. And I'm thinking especially some of the concerns that Rick Warren has set up this peace initiative that he runs.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I think the college, and recent college graduates among evangelicals could very much go in a more liberal democratic direction. I think the faculty at most evangelical colleges
is very liberal.
So, yeah. So I don't see how people are going to stay within the Republican fold that much longer. So I think the divorce
the Republican
is coming,
fold
but
has
it'll
to
be
change.
It'll be gradual.
We've seen that already with a rising number of moderates in the Republican circles.
Right.
Where the Republicanism and it's odd too that we have now both Republicans and Democrats appealing to Ronald Reagan. It just goes to show the things change over time. The Republicans today are not at all the same as they were 20 years ago, and certainly not the same as back when Lincoln was a Republican.
I mean, the ground changes, it shifts.
And speaking of those shifting grounds, though, do you think evangelicals have failed to adapt as conservatives? Do you think the two have developed in different paths and the evangelicals haven't kept up, or vice versa?
My sense from listening to someone like Michelle Bachmann or Sarah Palin, I don't think evangelicals have learned a lot
yeah.
in 30 years of hanging out with conservatives. And And so I think there, there's a kind of all or nothing approach, especially some of the moral issues, which is unfortunate, because I think that conservatives could make some real strides with, especially with pro-life matters, if they were willing to settle for some tertiary or secondary steps. Okay, we can't get it entirely abolished, but at least we'll get, abolish third trimester. Or the partial birth or something. There are various steps that we could move towards.
Start somewhere.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Or even, states' rights.
Mm-hmm.
I've said this many times in interviews I've been doing, but I do remember George Will wrote a column in around 1980 saying that perhaps 45 states in the Union may have abolished abortion
mm-hmm.
at the time. So 5 states would have made it legal. Well, imagine how many lives would have been saved in 30 mm-hmm. years if 45 states had abolished abortion. But because it's a sin, mm-hmm. and I understand that as a Christian, I could say, am willing to say that murder is a sin.
Yeah.
If abortion is a murder, okay, then it's a sin. I don't think it's
you
the same.
You can't compromise
right,
on
I don't
that.
Think it's, yeah. I don't think it's necessarily first-degree murder, but if as a violating the law, that's one thing, but as a sinful matter, that's another. And historically, evangelicals have always said we can't tolerate any sin, and that's good as believers to say that. But when you apply that to the civil polity, that means then we get prohibition for 15 years. We have no one drinking or distributing alcohol because it's a sin
legally,
right? As if that worked out. So, it may be possible to separate the abortion question from the sin question and say that we might, for the time being, tolerate some kinds of abortions legally just to get the ball moving in a certain direction. And eventually, we may have policies and legislation that would abolish it entirely. Mm. But especially starting where we are right now, that's just not going to happen overnight. And if it's always going to be all or nothing, then you're gonna get nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are a lot of different strategies and opinions on how to go into the public square,
right?
And how to vote as informed Christians, however we understand that, whether in a variety of 2K models or other types of approaches. There are all sorts of different strategies that Christians, evangelicals, try to employ. So there's some interesting things to discuss there and think about. What do you think about the current field in terms of, I don't want to exclude the Democrats, but we're presuming that Barack right. Obama's going to try to run again. That seems to be a foregone conclusion.
Right.
But according to your definition of conservative, are there any, this might be a dangerous question, but are there any conservatives currently running for president?
Well, Ron Paul really is the guy who I think, if you're an anti-federalist like myself and, you fall on certain sides of the debates about giving more power to the states and more power to local governments and trying to cut down on the consolidation and centralization of the federal government. I've the recent debates over the Obama administration allowing states more control over education when it comes to the No Child Left Behind policy, to think that there was a time when we didn't even have a federal Department of Education mm-hmm. and it was entirely controlled by the states. And now the federal government is entirely setting the policy.
Mm-hmm.
And now
you have conflicting standards too.
Right.
We're in standardized testing. The states will say one thing, the federal government another, and it's just a huge mess.
Right. So, I'm all for trying to give more power to state and local governments. And I think Ron Paul is that in that strain of American politics. On the other hand, I'm persuaded by many commentators who say that if Paul were to be elected, which is completely, I think, completely impossible, he could get the nomination. I really think that's possible because of the nature of the base in the Republican Party. And if certain other candidates keep burning out, it could come down.
The Kochs have enough money.
Right. But I think the government, I don't think he would be able to reduce the size of the federal government the way he said it. He would like to. So it would be turned over to Congress running most of national life. And that would be just a colossal mess, I think. So you would have a presidency with almost no power.
Yeah.
I think it would be a one-term presidency. So, you know, trying to be realistic as a conservative, it's got to be somebody who can maybe start to make some strides but still retain some of the power that goes with the executive office and goes with the size of the federal government as it's now construed. Mm-hmm. I don't see any Reagan-like figure out there. I don't have a good answer.
Yeah. Well, it's tough. Before we continue our discussion, what are some things you read that help you to think through some of these issues? If somebody wants to go pick up a publication, either a book, a magazine, a journal, anything, what are some good resources for conservatives?
The American Conservative Magazine is founded by Pat Buchanan. I know Pat Buchanan has a lot of detractors and people think he's kind of a wingnut. And certainly there are times when he can sound that way. But he's kind of an America First guy. And I do think that one of the things I like about Ron Paul, and this is one of the things that I think conservatives have real trouble understanding. I don't understand how you can be a small government Republican or conservative. Excuse me.
You're fine.
And advocate America's involvement in fighting the way we do around the world. I myself am in many ways proud of American accomplishments, even though I think during the two world wars and the Cold War, even though I wish we had not entered into the First World War, and perhaps I wish we weren't a superpower, but in many ways, I think America came out on the right side. But still, you can't have small government and big military. They don't go together. And most conservatives are pro-military, pro-big military, pro-big military budgets, and then small government. You can't have it. American conservatives is a place where you can go to hear some anti-war conservative anti-war arguments, and again, that's kind of mind-numbing for a lot of, especially Christian Republicans to think about. But then, Front Porch Republic is a website that's made up of paleo conservatives and a lot of thoughtful.
That's not Palin. That paleo is not.
No,
that means old.
Yeah. And again, that kind of stands for the kind of conservatism that developed in the 50s with Buckley and Kirk.
Yeah.
Where I used to work, the Intercollegiate Studies Institute has a lot of resources too, online and books and journals that make conservative arguments. So these are some of the places. And the Front Porch place, I think, is frontporchrepublic.org.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I can't
just do a Google search.
Or com.
I believe it's org.
You know, that has a lot of links to other resources as well. But anyway, those are some places that
it is com. Sorry. Those are an excellent website, and Daryl writes for that occasionally.
Right.
It's interesting. I spent a semester once a week. I would go down to D.C. to take a class at the Catholic University of America. And the Barnes & Noble in the metro station there, Union Station, has so much more fun stuff to read than a Barnes & Noble out here. You go to the newsstand, you can pick up the Cato Institute Journal, whatever.
Right.
And just a lot more offerings because of the people that are walking around the train station, of course. But there are a lot of things that people can read and come to an understanding. And some things that deal with philosophical and more baser concerns that are going to be applicable to non-Americans. I don't want to pretend, and I don't want to leave our international people who are listening to feel like they're getting neglected here.
Right.
So I want to turn my attention a little bit to some more of those baser concerns so they can apply them to their own situation. Why do you think evangelicals have generally been uncritical of modernity? You've taught intellectual right. history courses and then dealt with some of this stuff in the university level. Do you think that's a fair statement? And if so, what do you think
it
that's
is,
the
it
case?
It is fair. And in fact, I'm actually working with some colleagues at Hillsdale and also at Patrick Henry on a conference on Protestantism and conservatism and modernity. I mean, it's trying to think about how we can do something about this because I mean, part of it, I think, does have to do with the ambivalence that Protestants or evangelicals have about tradition. It comes much more readily to Roman Catholics, obviously. They have much more invested in tradition, and Protestants appear to be much more vulnerable about tradition, even though I don't think that that's as much the case as sometimes it's made out to be. And I think Protestantism developed in Europe and led to the modernization of Europe, not necessarily intentionally, but it did implicitly by the rise of the modern nation state, the confessionalization of the European states, by eventually introducing a diversity of beliefs that led to greater toleration for beliefs or non-belief. So there are politically, Protestantism was bound up with developments in Europe and in America that led to this kind of separation that we have between religion and politics, or secularization, or church and state, however you want to put it. And in a sense, Protestantism seems to be on the side of that kind of progressive change. And evangelicals or evangelicalism rose at a time when I think Protestantism developed when, you know, the last stages of medieval Europe. So Calvin, Luther, I think these guys' worldviews would have been still medieval in a lot of respects.
Oh, yeah.
But Wesley and Edwards and Whitfield would have been at a time when modernization, especially of markets, were developing. And even I think the appeal of the conversion experience back to that you know, the born-again experience theme, comes to people generally when they're adolescents or young adults, when they themselves are figuring out their own relationship to their parents, their own trajectory of their careers, what they're going to do with their lives. And in a non-traditional society, when it is possible to choose your own career, you're not going to simply just work on the farm that your parents worked on or the farm next door. You're not going to inherit your father's business, but you're going to have to go out and make it on your own, which is much more the conditions of modernity. Evangelicalism has oftentimes thrived in those settings where people are less tied to traditions of family, traditions of economics.
Wendell Berry.
Right. And so I think that's part of the reason why evangelicals have not been as discerning about modernity or modernization as well.
That's really fascinating. Along with that progression, coupled with modernity often is a technicism, or this idolatry of technology,
right.
and this understanding of the, it's almost this Hegelian thing. We just see technology marching along, continually synthesizing and advancing. One element of that, of course, is the mass media, which has been a funny animal ever since probably the 70s. It's really starting to come up. I think of the movie Network, you know, and we start to think about what's going on in terms of mass media in a television setting. Of course, it's been in the papers for many years. But do you think many evangelicals would read Marshall McLuhan or somebody of that sort and even have sensibilities similar to a Neil Postman in it or anything? What has the evangelical fascination with mass media meant?
Well, it goes back
to the church and for politics.
Yeah, I think it goes back to what we were just talking about, and not necessarily being as critical of modernity as they could be. And here, My ready answer is the the conversion experience. But the conversion experience is an unmediated, and supposedly unmediated encounter between God and the individual convert. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have.
So you mean unmediated outside of the means of grace and outside the church structure, the visible church structure.
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan Edwards' account or Charles Finney's account. I mean, it's sort of they're in the woods, they're alone, they have this. They have this vision almost, you know, so there's a presence of God that they sense. And so attention to forms or the means by which we hear about something or we see something, especially though when we think about the word preached or the even the sacraments we see and hear and taste and smell, but you know, there's less attention to the forms of the gospel. So the content form distinction.
Mm-hmm.
People think we can have the content, the form doesn't matter. So we can do mass media, and that's great. We can just reach more people. Same content.
Yeah.
The form doesn't matter. With the form of mass media, say,
comes
with
a change
radio,
in message. Right.
But you also, so I get Phil Reichen and Jim Boyce from 9 to 10 on Sunday morning. But then along comes the mainline Presbyterian church. So how many sessions are telling people, okay, these are the stations or shows you can listen to, but when that guy comes on,
you can't.
I mean, it's the same problem of itinerancy that was a problem in the first Great Awakening, where some old-siders thought, we don't want these revivalists just showing up in town uninvited without talking first to the local minister in the session. Does Chuck Swindoll check with the session before he starts to talk to you on the radio?
Right. It's interesting that now, because of that non-discernment, there's been a big fight over the last several decades to create media outlets so that you can try to win that battle. So you just try to be louder or larger or bigger and try to fight for people's attention via that route. But also there's been this competing trend in media where people are doing kind of a pull-based or a demand-centric model where they're trying to create media outlets that don't inform as much as it reflects what the people want anyway. I think that's what we've been seeing with MSNBC and Fox News, where they're not so much... There is some information. They're trying to present some information because they can't just not have any of it. But really, people are watching those stations not to learn so much as to reinforce what they already know and what they already want.
It's cheerleading.
Yeah. And so mass media, in a sense, has taken on the function of a mirror or an echo chamber rather than instruction. So we've seen those competing trends. It's been interesting and I don't know how to parse through it, but I think we're definitely not equipped to understand and we don't have thinkers, too many thinkers, at least thinkers that are being paid attention to, like a Marshall McLuhan or a Neil Postman. Those guys were popular in the 70s and 80s, but there just aren't too many critics out there even asking some of these questions. It's just assumed that mass media is here to stay, and it's a good thing in some sense.
And there, the market model, I think, does facilitate that or contribute to that, so that the bigger you're not going to tell people what they don't want to hear if they're going to turn off their television.
Yeah, your advertisers won't be happy.
Right. So your revenue.
That's why we don't do advertising media here.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, and the local church faces this in some way too. We live in a society now, as most Christians do around the world, of a voluntary church where the local landowners are not paying for the pastor. They're not patrons of the pastor, and the state certainly isn't giving any money. So our pastors have to cultivate a following and get people who are going to come and give to their ministry. So there's a certain sense we have a market model, even a local church. But when you get to know people, though, and you establish a relationship with them, and you understand that your pastor, and this is why that you know the Dutch used to call the pastor the dominee, the father, that he is sort of like your father. Your father is going to encourage you in all sorts of ways, but your father is also going to tell you things that you don't want to hear sometimes, but that you need to hear.
Right, the discipline. Mm-hmm.
But in the environment of an electronic medium, you don't have that kind of personal interaction.
Change
Chuck Swindoll doesn't know what I need to hear. You know, I don't know. Greta Van Susteren doesn't know me.
Right.
So, you know, that's a very abstract relationship, and they're looking there much more at numbers, polling data, you know, demographics of – and the Nielsen ratings and all that stuff as far as what's going to sell. And so even though we have, you know, a spectrum of a market that runs from Fox News to the local OP congregation – in the local OP congregation, there's still much more of a personal, human interaction. Somebody can still vote with their feet and leave if they don't like what the pastor's saying. Even if they're under discipline, they can leave and find another church that's going to take them. Unfortunately, but still, there's more of a personal, human relationship, and it's possible in that context to say things that aren't always going to be
of course. You have many different people that you address and bring up in this book, and we're not going to be able to touch upon all of these figures today, but perhaps there's certainly one, maybe two guys that I want to get through. Let's start with Francis Schaeffer. What happened when evangelicals discovered Schaeffer?
I was actually in Switzerland.
Did you go to Libri?
Yeah. When Schaeffer first appeared on the 700 Club. He was less in Switzerland during my time there than at other times. I think what happened to evangelicalism is that they got a whiff of neo-Calvinism or Kuyperianism. I think Schaeffer introduced the worldview outlook that he had learned partly, I think, through Ruckmacher and his time interacting with some Dutch Calvinists in Europe. And so you see LaHaye pick up on this in some of his books about worldview. Falwell certainly picks up on that, and it becomes a part of the Liberty University curriculum. So, in a sense, evangelicalism gets a little bit of a dose of Reformed worldview thinking. And I guess I'm not I think it adds to the kind of idealism that has afflicted evangelicals. So not only a kind of idealism when it comes to moral issues, but it also kind of idealism when it comes to ideas having consequences. And if we have somebody with the right worldview, it's going to lead to important changes in political. And I just don't think that's the way politics works. And I might sound cynical in the way I think politics works. I'd say it's much more realistic, though, because we live in a huge nation that has incredible resources and incredible wealth, and it's incredibly diverse. And when you put and on top of that, it's a democracy of some kind. You have a lot of different interests, both within the parties, but then, you know, also lobbyists and all sorts of. It's an incredibly messy world, and worldview thinking, I think, applied to that is going to hit a wall and self-destruct, or just become incredibly still more idealistic in thinking that we're going to, if we get candidates with the right worldview, it's all going to work out.
Yeah, no, that's interesting.
You know, I think a more biblical approach might be to simply try to make do as best we can with a modicum of order, a restraint of evil, rewarding good as much as possible, but just, you know, a bare bones kind of just, can we just get through till the Lord returns?
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about what the role of the state is, and those are even some deep questions that we debate over. What is the state supposed to do? Been reading more Meredith Klein lately, and I love his discussion of Genesis 4 and God's provision for Cain, and he roots the state in Genesis 4, understanding that its role is to restrain evil and promote justice. It's a very limited role for the state. And, you know, we can parse that out differently now, and we can come to public contracts about things like roads and stuff. That's fine. But the you know, at least according to Klein, the essence of the state is to do those two things, very mm-hmm. limited things. Daryl has a very excellent discussion on the moral majority and Jerry Falwell, also some interesting things on Chuck Colson. I'll leave those to the reader, kind of tantalize them a little bit to pick the book up and read those. But as we wind down, I wanted to bring up the figure Walter Rauschenbusch and get your thoughts on him. He was the father of the social gospel. And I'm curious to see what you think his influence is, if you could share that with the listeners on maybe a different side of evangelicals, a side of evangelicals we haven't really spoken about today.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he comes up in the book, right?
No, you mentioned Rauschenbusch.
Do I?
At some point, yeah. I wouldn't have it in my notes here okay. otherwise.
But
maybe
I guess,
not.
I mean, I don't. Part of the reason why I'm surprised that, if only because I may make comparisons, but I don't know that Rauschenbusch has any direct mm-hmm. influence on evangelicals, because Rauschenbusch, by the time evangelicalism is getting going in the 1950s, the division between evangelicals and mainline Protestants is pretty much assured,
mm-hmm.
and so Rauschenbusch is of no use to evangelicals because he's mainline or liberal.
I might be drawing a line here, you know, outside of the book. You treat him in your section on the faith-based right, and you are making some comparisons
right.
here. I mean, it's not a critical portion of your argument. But do you think Rauschenbusch has come back in with groups like the Sojourners at all? Do you think they're trying to pick up some of the things he was into? Or with a guy like Martin Luther King Jr.?
I don't think they are directly. I think, though, that his understandings of the kingdom— Mm-hmm. His understandings of the kingdom of God, especially how it's going to be coming, and the way that social justice can bring in the kingdom, can establish the kingdom, can establish righteousness and holiness mm-hmm. in a nation. Those are parts of Rauschenbusch's teaching and understanding of Scripture that evangelicals, both on the left and the right, are picking up on,
mm-hmm.
Whether they know it or not. And I continue to be somewhat amazed when evangelicals talk about social justice the way they do, both on the left and the right, or moderates in the middle, and not somehow think, well, wait, didn't the social gospel people do this? And I mean, they do understand that the social gospel was wrong or something about it was off. And yet they still are making arguments that are very similar, mm-hmm. and they're saying, well, it can't happen here. Of course, we're not doing that. We still believe in evangelism. We still believe in conversion. Well, so did Rauschenbusch.
Sure.
So did many of the social gospelers. But, I mean, they were both committed to evangelism and to reform, and so it's not a question of, well, if we're committed to evangelism, that's going to make it right. It's a question of, what do you think about the kingdom? How does the kingdom really come? And do these sorts of political reforms, certain kinds of social activism, does that really usher in the kingdom or not? So, I mean, that's really where I think the discussion needs to go. And amillennialism would be a great help
in
these discussions, both to respond to either the post-mills or the dispensationalists.
Where did he differ from someone like a Williams Jennings Bryan?
I guess I would say that, I mean, I think they were coming from different sections of America. So Rauschenbusch's experience was with the immigrants in an urban environment and uh-huh. seeing what those people were up against. And Brian was coming from the farms and the Grange and populism and seeing what farmers were up against in that time. Now, in some ways, they were both against those evil bankers and the big business and the monopolies. And they were both also probably opposed to war. I mean, Brian actually had to leave the Wilson administration over America's entrance into World War I because he didn't support war. He didn't think that kind of use of military force was appropriate. So in many respects, they were probably on the same page, but their constituencies were, or the people with whom they empathized and the people that they knew best were different, you know, urban working class versus rural farming folk.
And different, rooted in different perspectives.
Right.
Interesting. Now, you've, of course, mentioned that you've been kind of on the circuit for various reasons for doing different interviews. Is there anything you wish you had been asked in any of these interviews and haven't had the opportunity to bring up?
Well, the thing that's been striking to me that, and I was on with a station from Oregon, and it was relatively close to the time of his death, and I still had to bring it up. Is Mark Hatfield, the senator from Oregon, who was one of the crazier Republicans, and I think he's partly crazy in my estimation as a conservative, as politically. Because of his evangelical faith. And so he worked with McGovern on some bills opposing America's involvement in Vietnam War. He called for fasts and all sorts of other things. I mean, but Hatfield, what's striking about this historical account is that before the rise of the moral majority, evangelicalism looked like it was going to go left in the early 70s, both with Hatfield being as prominent as he was. Wallace was starting to come to the fore. There was this Chicago Declaration of 1973. Rich Mao was writing at the time, and by no means a liberal or lefty, but actually trying to engage politics in a more evangelical direction and in ways that would have moved the country away from the conservatives in the Republican Party. Evangelicals in the early 70s didn't like conservatism. Mm. And it's not until the bicentennial and reflection on what the founding of the country meant that you get a lot of sort of resuscitation of God and country and a civil religion. And then with the moral majority that people, almost no one remembers Mark Hatfield.
Exactly.
But he really was the Falwell of the 60s for evangelicals. I mean, Christianity Today was constantly interacting with him because he was the guy that evangelicals had in the Senate. I mean, he was a big figure in the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
And now evangelicalism has turned so far to the right, if you want to say that, that they can't even remember a guy like Hatfield that was even in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's one guy that I think is pretty interesting and is indicative of where evangelicalism was in the 60s and 70s.
Great. Well, I will conclude our discussion today to say that Daryl is not arguing that evangelicals should not be conservatives.
Right. Thank you.
You're welcome. So I got that right.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks so much for stopping by and for discussing this book. It has been a joy. Of course, From Billy Graham to Sarah Palin, it's available from Erdman's. I believe you can get it through the Westminster Bookstore. If not, you should be able to. But you can get it wherever fine books are sold. You can also visit Daryl online and interact with him if you'd like to read more. You can follow up and find out what else he's up to at oldlife.org. And you can visit Hillsdale, just do a search for Hillsdale College, and he's a visiting professor there. So it's an interesting place, isn't it, Hillsdale?
It is. I really enjoy it there.
Yeah. And would also
– liberal arts school, and it's actually a diversity of conservatives there that makes it very a lively place.
Mm-hmm.
And the students are kind of – they come having, you know, heard ads on Sean and Rush for Hillsdale, and they sort of think they're going to get more of that. And yet there's a real depth to conservatism that oftentimes people who only listen to Rush or Sean or watch Fox News don't understand is out there.
Yeah. And so visit that and learn more, because it is an interesting school.
Yeah. And when you asked me a resource, I should have said my institution.
Well, of course. Well, that was assumed.
Yeah.
Hillsdale College. Reform Forum is, of course, available at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs, and all of them are still available in the archives. You can download them, all of them in audio, many of them in video, for free of charge. And just visit us online there and do a search on the webpage, reformedforum.org. I want to thank everybody for listening and hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.